Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So, a great show ahead of us tonight in studio, Niall Hatch and Eric Dempsey. Niall, you're just back from, oh my goodness, all over the place, Madeira.
I was in Madeira and then after that in Gran Canaria. So, travelling to some of the islands in what's known as Macaronesia, this group of archipelagos in the Atlantic that were formed by volcanoes and which I think are Europe and Africa's equivalent to the Galapagos Islands. They really are that good. There are so many unique forms of flora and fauna out there. When I was in Gran Canaria, particularly, I recorded a special report for you. I think we're going to have that in a couple of weeks' time.
Yes, about?
It's about a wonderful bird, a very rare bird called the Gran Canaria Blue Chaffinch.
Mm.
Gran Canaria, it obviously gets lots of holiday makers. It's a big holiday destination, but so many of those people who are on the beach or whatever, don't realise it's actually the most amazing nature on that island, the most amazing pine forest, and this really unique bird found nowhere else on Earth. It was once considered to be extinct. It was thought to be lost forever. It was rediscovered, and now there's been a conservation programme to bring their numbers back up, and it's been very successful, and I was thrilled to see my first one ever. It was mind-blowing for me. Loved it.
Well, Eric Dempsey will be talking to you about another species that was extinct in Ireland,
yes,
but has been rediscovered. But before that, have you noticed any swallows on your travels recently?
It's funny, there's lots of swallows around at the moment. They were very slow arriving this spring. We had northerly winds, and if you can imagine a bird coming up from the south, you don't want to face into a northerly wind. We had prolonged northerly winds April into May, but they seem to have arrived in good numbers now, and I'm seeing lots of young birds being fed now, because I was very, very worried. Yeah, they depend on insects, and our insect population's in big trouble. So I was relieved, because for the first part of spring, May, there was hardly any swallows sitting on wires. There was no birds singing around the place. So,
well, you know your swallows, Eric. You made a documentary for us some years ago called From Egg to Africa, when you followed a swallow from its nest in Edenderry in County Offaly all the way to Africa. So I have a question for you. Are you ready? He's in the hot seat. Bring the lights down, please. Here we go. Eric Dempsey, can you describe the plumage of a swallow?
I can, of course. They're beautiful, dark, bluey black on the head, on the back and on the shoulders and on the wings. They've long tail streamers, and our birds have a lovely red throat with a little border of black underneath and white underneath.
Have you ever seen a pure white swallow?
I've seen one white swallow, but it wasn't pure white, as in an albino. It had little touches of orange on the underparts and a little touch of darkness on the upper parts.
Where was that?
That was at Decumption in County Wexford in the autumn. And it was a young bird because it didn't have long tail feathers. And it was flying with all of these swallows around Decumption, which is one of the staging posts.
How old are you now?
Oh, God, I'm 63.
63, you've only ever seen one white swallow in your life?
I'm 63 in about 10 days' time.
Well, happy birthday, Eric, in 10 days' time.
Yes,
well, I've got a little early birthday present for
you.
Fantastic. Because a lady by the name of Margaret, who lives in West Cork, we don't want to give away too much information, has got one white swallow on her property. Now, she did have more in the past. Anyway, let's say hello to her now. Hello, Margaret. Tell us about your swallow.
Well, there isn't much to tell, really. Only I have a white swallow. The first time was 2021. There was two white swallows, and they were nesting inside my own garage that I do keep the car. 2022, then there was two again, and with nothing last year, and this year now, I have this one only.
And how is it getting on with all of the other swallows?
Well, he's flying around happy out with them. Yeah, because you'd see him early in the morning, and just before I left for work now, they seem to be coming back for the nest for the night. They were flying into the garages now again, and he's flying around all with the rest of them.
Now, what colour are his or her eyes?
Oh, my God. I just right there. I don't know, I'll have to look at the picture again that I took.
You do that. Now, in the meantime, I have the photograph which you sent that was taken in 2021 of the two white swallows that were nesting in your shed. Are they albino? Have a look there, Eric and Niall.
Well, these are the 2021. Have a look at that, Niall. They are definitely albinos.
Yes, they have. You can see that. Yes, there's none.
They have no coloration on their beak. They've pink eyes, and these are two young birds. There's three normal swallows. So, you know, a swallow will have a brood of four or five normally. So of the five, two are pure white and they have pink eyes, which means they are albinos. Oftentimes you will find, you know, leucistic birds that are just lacking pigment, but these are pure albino birds, no question. It's possible that the adults who produce this clutch are back still producing white swallows, yeah, you know, year on year on year. So that's what
white albino swallows.
Yeah, possibly. We don't know until we see a photo of the bird from this year. And yeah, it's great that Margaret isn't going in and
no,
disturbing the bird,
which
is the
great
thing. But
let's explain the difference between albinism and leucism.
So albinism, with an albino creature, and plants can be albino as well, it's when they're lacking all pigment. So you don't see any pigmentation in, so in case of a bird, that means that their feathers will be white, but what we call their bare parts, so their legs, their beak and their eyes, will usually be pink. Because what you're seeing is you're seeing the blood vessels underneath there. So that's why albino creatures have pink eyes, because there's no pigmentation in the iris that obscures or hides the blood vessels. So you're actually seeing the pink of the blood. That's actually the same thing when we get red eye when in a camera, with a camera flash, it's because it's illuminating the blood vessels in your retina as well. So that's why that happens. What we're seeing in this case, we're looking at those two birds. They both look like young swallows. Indeed,
yes,
one of them certainly,
yeah,
is, because we can see it has a short tail. It doesn't have the, yeah, long tail streamers of an adult. The other one, the tail is obscured in this photograph from 2021, but it looks
it just
like
has
a youngster.
That feel, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it has that feel. It's small and it's sort of, yeah, you know, hunched up. Yeah.
And that's interesting to me, because that means that obviously there are two youngsters in the same brood that have this condition. Albinism is something that can arise spontaneously in any creature, but the fact of it is that the odds of it spontaneously arising in two siblings is almost infinitesimally small. So that does suggest that the parents are carrying some sort of gene, maybe a recessive gene, that's combining then and giving rise to this lack of pigmentation. So that's interesting. The parents are obviously passing this on. Just to say about the leucism, to cover that part of it, leucistic birds, they are lacking some but not all of the pigmentation. So in some cases, you could have a leucistic swallow that is completely white in its feathers, but it has dark eyes. Sometimes it might be a bird that has just a patch of white. Sometimes you see it with crows, where like a bird like a rook, for example, where instead of being black, they are sort of brown, like a manila envelope kind of colour. That, again, is another form of leucism. They're washed out in the pigment. So leucism has a bit of pigment or has some. Albinism, no pigment at all.
No, this fella his eyes seem to be black.
His eyes are black, okay, so we can rule out albinism then in that case, if he doesn't have the kind of pink eyes, you know?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So when did he arrive again, or she? Because we don't know if it's a male or a female.
He arrived there about a month ago, because my son seen him first. He said, "Mom, your white swallow is back," and so I seen him there a couple of evenings, and he took the picture up there on top of the, he was resting on top of the garage. Yeah. But I took one of himself, it was at night, himself and another ordinary swallow that were curled up for the night side by side.
Margaret, I'm fascinated by the fact that you've had white swallows over the last few years. Oftentimes, a bird that's white will stand out from the crowd and is often the first one that's picked off by a predator like a bird of prey. So the fact that you have birds that are obviously adults and coming back and have survived their journey to South Africa and returned back to you is an extraordinary thing. And then the second thing, the fact that you had one season, you had two white swallows, it obviously means that you've had the same birds coming back and passing that little genetic defect that creates this bird that has not as much pigment as the others. It's a leucistic bird. That genetic defect proves that the swallows you have nesting are birds that are coming back year after year after year and have probably been doing that for several generations. And when you think of the journey those birds have made, they will have left your garage or your shed, they will have travelled out of Ireland, across Europe, across the Sahara Desert, down to South Africa, spent the winter in South Africa and returned 10,000 kilometres back again and have come back to your house. What a privilege that is.
I never go near the nest. The nests are always there and I don't touch anything. You know,
well,
I just leave them come and go as they want.
That is just fantastic, because so many people sort of say, oh, they poo all over the place. But, you know, I always think it's a great privilege to be pooed on a bird that has flown 10,000 kilometres to get here. I think it's a real privilege. But that's just me. I'm perhaps a little bit mad.
I completely agree.
I like to protect the small birds, and I just leave them at peace and leave them do what they want. And
Margaret, that's exactly the right thing to do. Enjoy them from a distance like you are, and you'll be rewarded them with them returning year after year. Swallows are really faithful to the same nest site. And as Eric was saying, it's really interesting to be able to track the genetic lineage of this family with this defect in them. It seems that they're doing well, because very often white swallows, they have the odds stacked against them, because as Eric was saying, they're more vulnerable to predators, so they're more likely to be picked off by, let's say, a falcon or a hawk or something while they're migrating. But also for long distance migrants like the swallow, white feathers, they're more brittle, they tend to fall apart more easily. So when the bird is flying a long distance, it means that the flight feathers have wear and tear on them. That's why so many pale coloured birds have black wingtips, so they're able to prevent that kind of abrasion and wearing away. So these birds are really beating the odds. Amazing.
All I can say is that you have very, very special swallows. I've been bird watching for 45 years and I've only ever seen one. So
yes,
count yourself lucky.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of that when I seen the two white swallows. I said, I'll ask my brother and I'll ask my father. I said, I'd have the two more coming back to me.
Well, do you know, maybe they are, maybe they are.
Whatever gives you solace.
Yes.
It's never the same.
That's absolutely.
Well, Margaret, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Derek. No problem at all.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
God bless. Bye, bye, bye.
There goes Margaret, and I apologise for the quality of that line, but it is unusual. It really is.
It's unusual in the fact that these birds have survived to pass on that genetic defect. That's the real uniqueness about that, because white birds, besides, like as Noel said, their feathers are more brittle, they are picked off. A predator could judge if you're strong or if you're weak or if you're flying well, and they are the ones that are picked off usually. Mm. And oftentimes, if you have a bird that stands out from the crowd, they're often shunned from the other birds because they draw attention to that particular flock.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
and they themselves are probably completely unaware of this. They can't really see most of their own body, so they're not aware that they look in any way different. Yeah. It's interesting that this both albinism, lacking all pigment, and leucism, lacking some pigment, it's very rare in the natural world, but it does occur in many species in very rare cases. From what I see in the calls and emails and so on we get in Birdwatch Ireland and also through to Mooney Goes Wild here as well, it seems that blackbirds in particular seem to be more susceptible to this, or it's more prevalent in that. It's still very rare, but you do get quite a few reports of blackbirds with random white patches on their feathers, or even sometimes entirely white feathers. They seem to survive better than the swallows do because, of course, most of those are not migrating. They're able to hide in the undergrowth. They're not moving long distances generally, so they're not quite so susceptible. Whereas with the swallows, it does seem slightly more prevalent in swallows than in other species. Pheasants as well, another one you do see it in. I think what they have in common, I think it might be down to inbreeding. I think because swallows are so faithful to the same nest sites and they go back to the same place each year, and because their populations have been declining, I think that there's a smaller gene pool in certain areas, and therefore that any kind of genetic defect is more likely to be amplified in the population if related individuals are mating with each other. We see the same with pheasants. Occasionally you see white pheasants. They're often ones that have been bred in captivity for shooting purposes, and they're probably quite limited genetic stock as well and getting very inbred too. And of course, the pheasants particularly, they don't last long. A fox is going to see that very quickly. They really stick out like sore thumbs. But whenever you see these kind of aberrations in nature, it's interesting because it's so unusual to see that. And we kind of used to in field guides seeing what birds look like. But so don't always trust the pictures in a field guide. They can look different.
Yeah.
And of course, this also is how evolution happens. If it so happened that a white blackbird or a white swallow had some sort of advantage, this genetic quirk, this fault, could actually then end up being a huge advantage.
The norm.
Yeah. The norm, exactly. That's how all species have evolved. Well, it's mistakes.
It's like our red grouse. Yeah. Our red grouse, if you go to places like Scotland, you go to Northern Europe, the grouse there, they go white in winter. Mm-hmm. They don't go white in Ireland. They stay yellowy brown because we don't get long periods of snow. So in the winter, if it's snow and you're red, you stand out. So you change your plumage. Your winter plumage is white. But if there's lots of areas, like Ireland doesn't get that much snowfall. So being white on a red moor will stand out. So you don't, you know, the birds that are red, that stay red during the winter, are the ones that will survive in Ireland. But it's the opposite if you go to Northern Europe. And that, of course, forms subspecies. And
it does.
And ultimately then into speciation. Yeah.
We see it in the mammal world too, with the very distinctive Irish hare and the Irish subspecies of the stoat. They don't turn white in the winter, whereas across most of their range they do.
Perfect
the,
example, yeah.
The
yeah.
Irish hare is considered to be a very distinctive subspecies of the mountain hare, which is a widespread range across across a lot of the Northern Hemisphere, as does the stoat. In winter, the white stoats, they're called the ermines, but they don't look like that here in Ireland. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. It's all adaptation.
Yeah.
Now, Eric, you are working on a documentary for Mooney Goes Wild and Nature on One, our series of programmes broadcast during the bank holiday Mondays right here on Radio 1, about moths.
Yes.
M-O-T-H-S. Not moths.
Yeah, me moths.
Moths.
Yeah, my moths. It's like almost a confession. Like, I've got into moths, Derek. You know, it's something that I resisted for a long time. You know, I almost feel like I'm making a confession here on radio. I got very interested in moths a couple of years ago. I saw this beautiful moth on the wall of the house. It was a beautiful thing called a canary-shouldered thorn. Beautifully yellow. And I said, moths aren't meant to be yellow. You know, moths are brown. You know, they're meant to be sort of just dull and brown.
Mm-hmm.
And like my earliest recollections of moths was like in the back garden of Finglas, there was like millions of moths outside the light, the outside light. Or my sister calling me, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning because a moth had come in the window and, oh, it's flopping around the place. And, you know, so I was fascinated by this particular moth. And then I was down on Mizzen Head in Cork and somebody was trapping moths. Now, trapping moths is you have a box, basically, with panels on it, and you have a bright light, and the moths come in, attracted to the light, and fall down into the box, into which egg cartons are placed, right? Sounds mad. Egg cartons. And all the moths sort of fall asleep in the egg cartons, and, you know, they tuck in there for the night. They're sheltered from predators, they're sheltered from the rain, and you extract the egg cartons and you document the different types of moths. And I was amazed, like, they were picking 10, 20 species of moths, some of them incredibly coloured. So I decided to venture down the dark side of Lepidoptera. And moths get a bad name, right? Moths get a bad name. We all love butterflies, you know, because they're nectar and they pollinate, whatever. You know, and there's maybe 35 butterflies that you get in a year. You know, and that includes vagrants. But in Ireland, there's over 1,500 species of moths. Just about every single one of those are doing the exact same job that butterflies are doing. They're pollinators. There's only two species that eat your clothes, you know, before you say it. Because that's the first thing most people say.
Did you mention it, yeah?
Yeah, that's the first thing most people say. But they eat your clothes. Now, only two little tiny species eat your clothes. And every other one is harmless.
Well, why are we terrified of them?
Well, it's because...
Because we are. Well, yeah, a lot of people are.
You get these big ones and they flop around. And, like, you know, it's because they flap around the light. And that's... Yeah. And so...
They couldn't do anything to you if they wanted to.
No, that's the point. Many of them don't even have mouthpieces. You know what I mean? They don't even eat you.
They could eat your socks. No, they could eat your socks.
No, they're the larvae, you see. They're the larvae. No, trust me. It's only two species, you know. And when I started reading about moths, there was my first book... And I came, you know, I was looking through all these amazing sort of colours, and they're fantastic names and beautiful colours. And I came across the white prominent. And I read, you know, I said, that's a beautiful looking thing. It's white with orange, whatever. And it said extinct in Ireland. And I said, wow, we had that. I wonder what happened to that. And the story of the white prominent. There was an article written called The Extraordinary Tale of the White Prominent, because it was rediscovered in 2008, back in Ireland again. And it had been missing as a species for 70 years.
Who rediscovered it?
A team led by Dave Allen. Up in County Down.
Good night, and may your God go with you.
Exactly, yeah.
Not that Dave Allen.
The
late Dave.
Yeah, so... I have taken this story and I am following the whole history of the white prominent, because it's,
my goodness,
it's only found in one area in County Kerry. It's not found in Britain. There's only two or three records from the 1800s. and then it's only into Europe. So this little population is an isolated population of a species that somehow is still present in Ireland, even though its nearest population is in Europe. It was found in the 1850s, a handful. The guy who found it was a guy called John Bouchard, and he was a famous entomologist. But because they were so rare, they had value, monetary value. For example, one sold for 21 guineas back in 1856. Imagine that money. That's like something else back then. And people started accusing him of taking specimens from Europe and pretending that he'd caught them in Ireland.
Oh, no.
Yes. So it was all this sort of back and forward until several more were found. But they usually had about a 15-year gap.
Wow.
And then the last ones were around the mid-1930s.
Well, just before we move on, Eric, I've got up the currency converter from 1270 to 2017. I've used this before. It's in their National Archives. Anyway, so we'll pick a year. So we'll go 1860. You said 1856, didn't you? And then shillings and pounds and guineas. So if I've got this correct, so 81 guineas is about 81 pounds. I hope I've got that correct. So I'm going to now press the button which says purchasing power in 1860. So for that 81 guineas, you could have bought 5 horses, 15 cows, 122 stone of wool, 40 quarters of wheat, and it would have paid a skilled tradesman for 405 days of work. Anyway, continue.
Do you know what? It's like tales of the unexpected.
Do you know, it sounds like it's going to be fascinating. And I know you like moths as well, don't you?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. Moths are really, as you said, Eric, underrated. People don't realise just how special they are. And whenever I'm talking to groups of kids, I always, in a school or setting like that, I always say, what do caterpillars turn into? And they always say, butterflies. And the vast majority of caterpillars you encounter are going to turn into moths.
Moths. Yeah, absolutely. And like, what amazed me is I started putting out the moth trap in the back garden, and in 3 years, I've recorded over 400 species of moth in the back garden.
Just in your garden alone?
Just in my garden alone.
Wow.
So it just shows you, you know, they're out there. But again, like everything else, they're under pressure from habitat loss and absolutely everything. But the white prominent, it's a fantastic tale.
It's a great story, great mystery. We look forward to it. Now, I was visiting my father the other day, just down the road here, and one of the locals came up to me with a question about magpies. So here's Ken.
I have a question for the Muni Goes Wild team. Every morning in Herbert Park, I feed the magpies, but one of them is real aggressive, and it's torn all the tail feathers out of another magpie. Will they grow back again?
Niall, you take that one. That's a good one.
So magpies can indeed be feisty, and they do have a hierarchy among them. They do lead to squabbles, and they will attack each other sometimes. It sounds like this poor magpie that has lost its feathers in this case must have done something wrong, some sort of transgression within the flock, and it's been punished maybe in this way, because magpies really do that kind of thing. Now, to answer the question directly, in most cases, yes, those feathers will grow back. It takes a few weeks generally for them to come back, but they're usually pretty quickly, you wouldn't notice much difference. They grow back fine. The only exception to that is if the actual follicles that they grow from have been damaged, and if that happens, then sometimes they'll have a bald patch or the feathers won't come back. Particularly when it comes to the tail feathers of a bird, they're actually designed through evolution to come away quite easily. And the idea behind that is that if a fox or a cat or something pounces on the bird, very often it'll land on the tail. The bird will be able to then fly away, leaving the tail behind, and then will regrow the feathers from that. So yes, you know, it's a good time of year, I suppose, or at least it's not a disadvantage this time of year to be missing feathers so much. Much worse for a bird if it happens in the winter, because then it will ruin the insulation properties of their body. Even a small gap in their feathers can lead to hypothermia. So at this time of year, it's better that it happens in the summer than in the winter, I would say.
But, absolutely. Yeah. But there's one other thing as well, in case people sort of see magpies going around with missing tail feathers at this time of year, or even almost tailless, mm-hmm. is that after the breeding season, adult birds shed every single feather on their body. Every single feather falls off. Now, it doesn't go vump. They don't become naked. Like, it's gradual. But if you see gaps in, wing feathers or on tail feathers of birds like magpies, this is what's called a post-nuptial molt. after the breeding season, your main feathers are very worn because you've been going in and out of a nest and various things like that. So anybody who sees a tailless magpie or a magpie with lumps missing from its tail, do not assume it has been attacked by another magpie. At this time of year in the summer, birds are naturally molting their main feathers, all of their feathers, and they often will do it gradually, one by one or two by two, and regrow them slowly. So you might see a crow going along and there's a big gap in the wing, but you'll see that there's two or three brand new feathers growing and two or three tatty feathers the other side of the gap. So they're slowly but surely molting out their main feathers. So it's not an assumption that if you see a tailless magpie, it has been assaulted by another magpie.
Yeah, okay. And if you're interested, you can listen to the wonderful documentary we broadcast recently about the magpie. Just visit our website, rte.ie/mooney. Thank you for that, Ken. Now, Niall, what can you tell me about peregrine falcons?
Peregrine falcons are truly amazing birds. Mm-hmm. They're probably the bird that first captured my imagination when I was a little kid. And I still remember seeing my very first one. Birds of prey, to children particularly, to anyone of any age, they're really cool. But the peregrine falcon, it is the fastest animal on the planet. And this blew my mind when I was a kid, because we're always told, well, the fastest animal is the cheetah. And it is when it comes to running on the ground, and they're very fast. They can go up to 120 kilometres an hour, which is very impressive. But the peregrine in flight can reach speeds of over 350 kilometres an hour. I think that the highest recorded speed ever, accurately recorded, was one doing a dive after its prey from a height. It reached 389 kilometres per hour.
Wow.
Astonishing. And they're beautiful looking as well. But to me, they were always like the pinnacle of evolution. This was like the ultimate bird. They look like fighter jets. That's what they look like. We nearly lost them. They nearly went extinct. And now you can see them again quite widely across Ireland again. So they've made a resurgence, and one of those success stories. It's always nice to have a success story in nature. We get so much doom and gloom, so many species under pressure. Well, peregrines are doing well again.
Where do they traditionally nest?
So they would normally nest on cliffs, sea cliffs and also inland cliffs. Then they'd be found in quarries, places like that. And they're a very widespread bird. They're found in a wider area of the world than any other bird species. They breed and occur across six continents, so all continents except Antarctica. You can find peregrine falcons. So they're very efficient at what they do. They hunt other birds and they nest usually in cliffs.
Well, tall buildings that we have here in our cities are just man-made cliffs, are they not?
Exactly. They make a very good proxy for a cliff. And of course, within an urban area, you have lots of pigeons, which would be probably the favourite food of a peregrine falcon.
And a good place to find peregrines right now is in Cove in County Cork. And that's where we're going right now. To our man on the ground there, Jim Wilson. Jim.
Well, Derek, thank you very much indeed. I'm here in Cove on a beautiful sunny evening, a little bit breezy, but absolutely beautiful. And I'm with Alan Farrell, who your listeners should be familiar with now from the Dawn Chorus last year and a number of contributions to the programme, good friend of the programme, and also Alan McCarthy. And Alan McCarthy was the man we spoke about, the Barnalls before, and hen harriers. And this evening we're talking about another bird of prey, which is the peregrine falcon. And really, I think I'll let Alan Farrell take up the story from the beginning, because Alan really has been the mover and shaker in getting this project to where it is. Alan, can you give us a sort of a review of what it was like?
Sure, absolutely, Jim. Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, I'll start it when we became aware that there was peregrines on the cathedral spire. And I mean, that wasn't news to any birders in the Cork locality, because I'd imagine there's been peregrines on the cathedral spire since it was built. Back in, I think it was 1919 when the spire was added to it. So that wouldn't be unusual. But what we were hoping to do was to prove that they were actually nesting in the cathedral. And as luck would have it, through a chance introduction, I managed to get up there a couple of years back and do a full survey of the whole spire, basically, with a view to seeing were they actually nesting up there. But unfortunately, we didn't find any nests at that time. So we came to the conclusion that they weren't nesting there. But strange one, because we were seeing juveniles there late in the summer. So the theory then was that they were maybe bringing in juveniles from elsewhere and using the cathedral basically as a learning platform where the adults would show the youngsters how to hunt. Because what happens is, as soon as the youngsters fledge the nest, they're still dependent on the adults to feed basically until they learn the skills of hunting themselves. So We still do have an active peregrine nest within a couple of kilometres of the cathedral. But and it's, would you believe it's actually in an old derelict chemical plant? No, unfortunately, that plant is planned to for demolition, and the actual tower that they're nesting in is due to be demolished within the next couple of years. So basically, we were anxious to maybe provide another platform in the locality where we could maybe entice these birds in to nest still within the Great Island Cork Harbour area. So what happened was we basically made approaches to the clergy and the powers that be within the cathedral itself, and we found we were pushing an open door once we explained what we were about and what the peregrine is and what they feed on, because would you believe there is a feral pigeon problem in the cathedral where they've been known to get into the cathedral and upset proceedings in there. So basically, as I say, we were pushing an open door. So it all happened back in, it was actually, would you believe, it was New Year's Eve. I'll never forget it. It was actually New Year's Eve in 2022 when a good friend of mine built the box in his workshop. We disassembled it and we had to get it up the cathedral to the location where it is at the moment. So that was a daunting task, because the tip of the spire of the cathedral, would you believe, is 300 feet high, and the platform, the area where we were going to mount this platform, is actually 200 feet high. Now, what you have is inside in the guts of the cathedral, basically, you have a spiral stone staircase, which was built back in the day. So we basically disassembled the box and had to hump the whole thing up to 200 up to 200 feet and reassemble it in its present location in one of the mini turrets on the side of the cathedral. Yeah, everything was going swimmingly. That was the, as I say, New Year's Eve 2022. And lo and behold, a pair of peregrines showed great interest in it in the spring of 2023. So we said, yes, fingers crossed, this looks very promising. But alas, they didn't nest in it. Despite a lot of activity, both adult birds in and out of the nest box regularly, showing the typical courtship behaviour. But unfortunately, we got a look into it from a local high point, and no eggs or chicks that year. So again, the same thing repeated itself in the spring of this year, spring of 2024. A pair of adults showed interest in it again. And this time, the behaviour was way more positive. They were doing a lot of food passing, where basically the male would fly in with prey and a female would come out from the cathedral spire and he would pass it to her midair. A spectacular sight if anyone has ever seen it. And to see this basically over our own, over the town, I mean, we're in a very urban environment here. The town of Cove is a big town on the south coast of Great Island in Cork Harbour. And to be able to see these fantastic apex raptors going about their business over the town of Cove was absolutely fantastic. So again, we managed to get a look into the box in early spring of this year, 2024. And lo and behold, we could see two fluffy grey balls in the corner of the box. So it was, to say the least, we were delighted. Thrilled was the word, actually. We've been basically monitoring the progress of the birds since then.
And then, of course, this is where the other Alan comes in, which is, You're involved in a national project, I think it is, to tag, to ring these birds and find out more about them. So, Alan, could you tell us a bit about the project, what's involved, and then what you had to do at the cathedral, which is probably a nesting site you wouldn't be familiar with too often getting at and dealing with the chicks then?
Yeah, so it's a national project, a colour ringing project, which is coordinated by the National Parks and Wildlife Service. So what we do down here in Cork is that we try to locate, you know, nest sites that we can actually access to be able to colour ring the chicks. So the idea of colour ringing the chicks is that we're able to tell then their survival rates, where they disperse to, where they end up nesting themselves. And that, of course, that's very valuable information in terms of, you know, learning about their kind of breeding ecology, their overall life history. So at this nest site, it was a very nice nest site to visit, of course. And all the ringing that we do is, of course, under license from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. So it was quite the long trek up the spiral staircase.
And of course, we had the ringing of the bells.
Indeed, yeah.
Pardon the pun.
Yeah, we had to dodge.
We had to pass the bells, yeah. Which was amazing.
Yeah, block the ears, ready for the ding.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was quite a spectacular nest site, really. So we went out onto the turret where the nest box is, and there were two very healthy chicks. So there was one male and one female. The female was very good weight; she was over a kilogram. While the male
was. And how old would she be at a kilogram? How many days old would she be roughly, or weeks?
So when we ranged them, they were around 3 weeks old.
Wow. So in 21 days, she went from hatching to being 1 kilogram in weight.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, they really, really pile on the weight very fast. So both of the chicks were grand and healthy, and thankfully Alan has been observing them ever since, and they both managed to successfully fledge, and there's one of them currently perched up on the cathedral.
As we speak.
It's
amazing. And then... You know, we noticed the difference in obvious difference in size between the male and the female, the adults, the parents. Do they begin as different sizes, or does the female outstrip the male as it gets to fledging?
So in the very early stages of development, they would be a similar size.
Look away.
But then within a week or two, the size difference would begin then.
Wow.
So like even when we ringed them, when they were 3 weeks old, the female was over a kilogram and the male was around 500 grams.
Wow.
So there's quite the size difference even at that stage. And it's not just in terms of weight, it's also in terms of tarsus length. So the female's tarsus is a lot longer than the male.
It's at the end of
the lower part of the leg.
The lower part of the leg is...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's longer. Okay, yeah. So you can sex them...
You can, yeah. So sexing them based on weight is fairly reliable, but of course there's a bit of a grey zone where both of them can be a certain weight. But if you combine that then with a tarsus and toe measurement, then you can sex them very reliably then.
From the studies being carried out in Ireland and elsewhere, do we have any idea, will these young birds wander? Because, of course, the name peregrine is an old English name for a wanderer. So do they wander a lot before they settle down?
They can do, yeah. Like with peregrine falcons, they typically they can settle down within the first full year of their lives. So by the second calendar year, they can start to set up a territory.
Okay.
They don't typically breed, though, until the following year after that then. Yeah. So their third calendar year.
Yeah.
But like, for example, we have another nesting platform in the city. And we have a camera on that nesting platform, and there's actually an immature male that has taken up residence.
Right.
So that bird is only a year old now. So, we don't know where he came from. He could have come from, far up the country. He could have been from Cork, even. Mm-hmm. We don't know, which is, why we're doing the study.
Mm-hmm.
But, they can settle very fast, essentially.
Okay.
Is it fair to say, Alan, that it's the actual male that holds the territory? So, because that's what I've been noticing here. Before the female showed up, the male seemed to be there. We have an annual bird race here, Jim, as you well know, on the Great Island. It's been running for the last 30 years. And typically it starts down the middle of the town on the first Saturday after Christmas. And the first bird always ticked on the Great Island Bird Race is the peregrine, because the first thing anyone does is turn around and look up at the spire. And typically it's always the male. So I'm just curious, is it the male holds the territory so over the winter period, for example?
Normally it would be, yeah. Yeah, normally it would be. The males tend to hold the territory. Sometimes, of course, you can get variation. If a male dies, for example, you might have the female hanging around. Sometimes the pair hang around all winter. Sometimes they both disperse. It's fairly variable between individuals and sites.
Yeah, as Alan Farrell already alluded to, the other Alan, about them being a top predator, they're as noisy as be damned for a nesting bird. I mean, they really don't hide their presence.
Definitely
not. It's easy to find a nesting site by sound alone, almost. I presume it's because they don't have any fear of... They don't have to keep quiet.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, nothing will threaten a peregrine falcon, except a human being, unfortunately, which is certainly a big problem in Ireland in certain areas. But for peregrines in general, yeah, they don't have any predators themselves, so they're able to shout as loud as they want.
And the prey... Alan Farrell, you've been observing them hunting. I've seen them hunt from literally using the top of the spire right up on the cross.
Well, that's a very good point, Jim.
What have you seen, and what sort of prey are they bringing in?
Yeah, as I mentioned previously, the very top of the spire on the cathedral is actually 300 feet, which is actually the biggest, it's the highest church spire in the country, would you believe? And what I've noticed is that when they often perch lower down on the cathedral, maybe two thirds of the way down. But when they get serious and they're really going to, you know, look for something to bring into the, they'll move to the very tip of the cathedral. And when you see them moving up there, keep that's when you need to lock onto them really, because any passing bird in within a mile and a half, 2 mile radius is fair game to them at that stage. And I've seen them doing the typical stoop and the high speed manoeuvre where they actually strike a bird in the air and bring it back in. Prey items was very interesting actually when we got up there to look at the nest platform. The majority of the prey at that stage when we were doing the ringing was actually starlings, particularly juvenile starlings. But I've been up there over the winter and did a little bit of a mini survey of the prey items that were up there, and was most unusual actually. Just a lot of them are actually waders. Snipe, several snipe up there, black-tailed godwit, black-headed gull, plenty of feral pigeons. And even at one stage, I found the remains of a black-headed gull up there as well. So what I thought was interesting was the snipe and the black-tailed godwit, which would kind of suggest to me, because a peregrine falcon hunts in flight as such, and the majority of these birds, particularly in the winter, would be flying by night. So I was just curious. I wonder, are they actually hunting by night here because of the ambient light over the town and over the harbour area in general, you know? So further food for thought, I think. More research needed in that area, I think. But it's fascinating, yeah. I think, can you hear? You can. Oh, here, yeah. We go. We have a peregrine calling overhead. Right on cue. So what we have now, Derek, here is when one of the adults is after coming into the location, yeah, the area of the main spire, and one of the juveniles is calling to be fed, I imagine, at this stage of the evening. So maybe they're waiting for the last evening feed. But in answer to your question, Jim, yeah, we found some unusual things. I got a bit of a clip, a video clip of the peregrine, one of the adults bringing in what I assumed was a coot when I looked at it initially, which was most unusual because we don't get coot on Great Island, would you believe? But when we analysed it further on the bigger screen on the computer, what we actually discovered was it was a juvenile moorhen, would you believe? Which I found was most unusual for a peregrine to take a juvenile moorhen, because they will take birds, water birds, for example, in some parts of the States. They're known as the duck hawk, I believe, Jim, is it?
That's
in,
correct.
Yeah, the duck hawk, yeah. Where they've been known to basically fly through wetland areas and scatter the flocks of waterfowl and waders that would be in there. So, yeah. The unusual one I thought, well, twice we saw it actually, was where the adult brought in a juvenile moorhen for the youngsters.
That really is very interesting to hear, because you're describing there that famous stoop that the peregrine falcon does, that dive from the sky from a great height at a tremendous speed, the fastest animal in the world. They can go at speeds of well in excess of 300 kilometres an hour. And they would normally do that quite high up. The birds would fly relatively high. Moorhens, I really don't think of them as being high flyers. They can fly quite well, but they fly low over the water or maybe between little bits of vegetation around reed beds and so on, not very high. So it would strike me that peregrine was taking a risk. If it did a stoop to get that, it was very close to the ground when it did it.
Could we go straight into the water. Yeah. And the other interesting thing you were talking about, Alan, was the nocturnal, do birds, you know, peregrines hunt birds nocturnally. Of course, with cities, there's an ambient light there. So, you know, that might explain why they might hunt during the night, because in some of the nests in the Dublin area where we had, you know, we have birds on Pool Beg, woodcock, for example, has been found. So are these birds, like the peregrines, you know, the theory is that they may be woodcock migrating over Dublin Bay, or are the birds, like the peregrines, actually going up to places like surrounding Dublin where there are woodcocks roading? So I don't really know. It's a very interesting subject.
It is. It's fascinating, actually. And as you say, I mean, when I was up there now, it was in the depths of winter, so I wouldn't be disturbing the resident birds up there. And so that would suggest to me that they were migrating birds that they were taking, particularly the black-tailed godwit. And the snipe, yeah, most unusual. And what I actually discovered they were doing was they're kind of caching, because most of these prey items were quite fresh. So they were kind of caching the food up there, is what I thought, maybe for leaner days ahead. I don't know. Who knows?
That would also make sense, you know, particularly in winter, because, you know, you could get really foul weather. Excuse the pun. you get really bad weather. So it may might make hunting really, really difficult. So they just put a cache there and they just sit and sit there all day.
If you're going after migratory birds, it is a very ephemeral food source.
Yes.
You can't guarantee that, you know, that they'll continue to go. I guess that's one of the reasons why peregrines, particularly in urban areas around the world, not just in Ireland, tend to do quite well now. It's because they at least have a fairly ready supply of feral pigeons. And that's something that they can feed on quite dependably around urban areas. And in doing that, of course, then they're helping to keep the populations of those birds in balance. It's pretty important, especially when you consider that the peregrine falcon, we nearly lost them, not just in Ireland, but globally. Back in the 1950s and 60s, they were hit very badly by a pesticide called DDT, which was used to control insects on crops. Now, these peregrines, they don't eat the insects or the crops, but what was happening was they were feeding on the birds that were feeding on the insects or on the seeds that were full of DDT. It didn't seem to have any effect on the birds themselves until it came time for the female to lay her eggs. And this chemical made the eggshells much thinner than they should be, and they were
very brittle.
Very brittle, weren't they? They were, and they would break either when being laid or during incubation. The species was nearly wiped out. So it's really good to see them now coming back. DDT is banned in most places around the world, and it's taken a long time for the peregrines to come back, but now they have. They would have traditionally have been a bird you would associate with cliff areas and I suppose cities, and especially cathedrals. That's as far as they're concerned, a cliff.
Yeah, that's a cliff. Yeah, I mean they're nesting on the chimneys and pool bag, you know, in a nest box there. So, you know, what a view. I always often look at the peregrines on Pool Beg, and whoa, what a view, right over Dublin Bay down to the Wicklow Mountains, and from that height you can look all the way up towards Carlingford. Oh, it's a fabulous view.
You'd like your private eyrie up there, would you, Eric?
I would actually.
Are they taller than the cathedral spire? I don't think.
If
the cathedral spire is 300 feet, Alan, I think you said earlier it was 1919. We just
1919, checked. 1919, Derek, when the spire was added, would you believe? The cathedral was actually, the construction of the cathedral started in the mid-1800s, but there was a lot of toing and froing, shall we say, with various builders' problems and architects changing plans, etc. And the main body of the cathedral was finished around the late 1800s, but the actual spire, which is the crowning glory, shall we say, of the building, wasn't added until the start of the 1900s, completed in 1919, I believe.
Just check there on the pool bag chimneys. one is slightly higher than the other. The higher of the two is 681 feet and 9 inches.
Oh,
which
wow.
Is,
it's a good view.
Yeah, 207.8 metres.
Wow. So twice as high as the spire.
Yeah.
And sorry about that, boys in Cove.
Okay, we'll take that hit.
Every time I'm in Cove and I look at the cathedral, I think of Laurel and Hardy, Jim.
Oh, yes. Yes, they came in here. My dad actually took, as far as we know, the only photographs of them coming off the ship. And as they were doing that, the father of the current Carillionaire, Adrian Gabrours, Staff Gabrours was his father, and he played their signature tune that you always heard.
The Cuckoo's Theme.
That's the one at the start of their films, and they were quite taken by that apparently. But my dad was saying that they were a little bit tired of so many people crowding around trying to see them, because when they came here, as far as I know, they were no longer at the peak of their careers, and they were doing a tour of, I think, Ireland and Britain and Europe. And he remembers them not being quite so. I think it was Ollie was the one that was not being so so polite and nice when they were coming off. And we've got great photographs that my dad took of that. And yes, so you know these peregrines we reckon are tone deaf, are stone deaf, or they don't mind them because they don't even flinch, and the bells are relatively loud. Like we had to go up past all the bells, all 48 of them, including the one that rings out at the Angelus at 6 o'clock every evening. That's St. Colman, the biggest of the bells, and no problem to them at all. It hasn't bothered them. I mean, they think it's a glorified cliff, basically, you know, somewhere nice ledge. Lots of easy food nearby. I mean, they really are lazy in the sense that they can sit at 300 feet. In fact, 400 feet if you count the 100 feet from the water. So they can sit at a height of 400 feet and have the luxury of just sitting there waiting till they see something they want to try and catch. And then they literally drop off. And as they stoop, which is what they call when they drop, hitting in excess, believe it or not, now of, I can't believe it, it's over 300 kilometres, 350 kilometres an hour. And they reached that speed in less than 10, 15 seconds. And God help the bird that's at the receiving end of something moving that fast.
Oh,
and
my
that's
goodness.
How it gets them. But fantastic to see. And the whole town now is aware of them because of the noise.
The whole
but
country
also,
is.
Yeah, no, superb. Really good. Well worth the visit. I mean, there's peregrine probably here most of the time. They're not very, very close. You'd need your binoculars. But they've got a nice safe distance. I mean, as Alan was saying, you're not supposed to go near the nests, you know, and you have to get a license to come and ring them and all that. So we're delighted that they've nested in a lovely secluded spot, thanks to the clergy and the diocesan committee who
actually
on that
point, Jim, could I just make a special mention and a word of thanks to Father Tom McDermott, who is the parish administrator here in Cove, without whose permission and encouragement, actually, we managed to get the box up there. And also Mr. Peter Daly, who is the maintenance manager of the cathedral. He was the guy that got me up there initially to carry out the initial surveys, and helped with getting access to the cathedral from going forward. So thanks to both gentlemen.
All right, Jim, and another little bit of information for you. It says here, St. Colman's Cathedral in Cove. Perhaps the most notable installation is the Carillion. St. Colman's Cathedral has an impressive 49 suspended bells in total, which is the largest in both Ireland and Great Britain. So there you are.
That's correct. And every now and again, Adrian Gabrorsk does a recital to an audience of obviously thousands, because you can hear the bells sometimes from even across the harbour. And he plays everything from religious music right down to, he's even had the Beatles playing up there on the bells. And he uses an instrument that looks a little like the keyboard on a piano. It's not this thing, this vision of him dangling off a rope, you know, and going up and down like you see on the television sometimes. It's actually, he actually sits down, and you can find the videos online to see that. And he hammers the keys and plays some amazing music with those 49 bells.
Oh,
so they're
fantastic.
In good company up there.
They certainly are. Anyway, Jim and Alan the two Alans, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Cove in County Cork. Thank you, guys. Good night. Bye.
Thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.
There
bye-bye.
Are the boys. Absolutely fascinating stuff. I haven't seen a peregrine falcon for donkey's years, I have to be honest.
Oh,
no,
God,
I haven't.
No, I was watching one, you know, around Wicklow only yesterday, the day before. Yeah, it's they're doing okay along the east coast as well. But I sorry, just because I was thinking of Quasimodo
when you were looking at me.
Yeah,
Jim's not that bad
looking. Sanctuary,
yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much indeed to everybody who took part in today's programme. We'll do it all again next week at the same time. In the meantime, you can visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, boys, on the count of three, a collective bye. One, two, three, bye!